Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 14 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. After two very successful episodes featuring Paul Heckingbottom and Hugo Langton talking about the coaching side of football, this week we are returning to strength and conditioning. This week I am joined by Callum Walsh. I was introduced to Callum by Paul Bauer from Barnsley Football Club. I'm really excited to have Callum on the podcast. Callum is currently working with Exos at Atlético Paranaense in Brazil. Atlético Paranaense is currently in the first division in Brazil, and I thought it would be really good to talk about a place that is really revered in the hearts of soccer fans and football fans throughout the world. In this episode, Callum touches upon injury prevention, FMS screening, strength and conditioning culture in Brazil and at Atlético Paranaense, and resume advice for young strength and conditioning coaches. Really good information. Really excited to get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I would like to introduce Callum Walsh. Callum came very well recommended from Luke Jenkinson and Paul Bauer, who were both previously on the podcast. So I'm extremely excited to have him on. Callum, how's it going?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. So Callum, just to start us off, can you give us a little bit of background in terms of your education and where you're currently at?
Yeah, no problem. I'll probably best start off with my university. So started at Liverpool John Moores University, and that's where I obviously know Paul from. Graduated from there in 2008. Took a bit of a year off, was a bit fed up of education and thought I didn't really need any more than a degree. And then I soon realized that I needed more than a degree. So I then went back and did my master's degree in strength and conditioning. And that was at Bolton University, which was the first one in the country at that time that did that master's course. And then from there, it kind of led on to different roles and different opportunities to where I'm currently finding myself working for Exos out in Brazil at a club called Atlético Paranaense.
Fantastic. So when you first started off your career, what club did you start off at?
My very first club was Shrewsbury Town, which at the time was a League Two club in England. So I think it was about 23, 24 at that time. So it was a great opportunity just to kind of get my foot in the door, really.
So what did you start off doing at Shrewsbury Town?
So basically what happened was I happened to do my master's course with the head of medical from Shrewsbury Town. And we got chatting and they were kind of looking for someone. So we started talking about some things that could be ideas, and he invited me down to talk to the manager, who was Paul Simpson at the time, and got on great. And he was really into sports science and strength conditioning and anything that we could put forward that we thought would benefit them. So we were doing sort of injury prevention sessions, strength sessions, some rehab sessions to help players obviously get back on their feet. So it was probably a little bit minimalist in terms of facilities and equipment, but it was a great learning curve and a fantastic opportunity to start with.
After Shrewsbury Town, you mentioned in our conversation prior to the podcast that you actually came over to the United States and did an internship at IMG. So what made you make that transition from Shrewsbury Town and then come here to the States?
Well, to be honest, it was something that was mentioned by, funny enough, the manager's son. He kind of had a friend that had gone out and done it the previous year and kind of thought, you know, is that something that you should do, or, you know, is it something you'd be interested in doing? And I'd always liked America. So I thought, you know, that was deemed kind of the home of strength conditioning. So I thought it'd be a great learning curve. So I was still quite young. So I applied for it, didn't think I'd get it, got a phone call, went through the interview process, and then I had to make the decision. And at the time, I went to the manager, who was Paul Simpson, and said, listen, I've got this opportunity. It would mean me missing part of the season, but I think it would be good. And he fully agreed with me and said that, you know, I should go and do it with his blessing and everything. And then football being football, things kind of turned around and he kind of left Shrewsbury at the end of the year, so everything changed. So I ended up not even going back to Shrewsbury. But to be honest, the opportunity to go there and learn at such a young age was kind of too good to pass up. So it was a risk that I still feel now was worth taking.
What were your first impressions when you came over to start your internship at IMG?
There was a lot more positivity about the place. So, you know, coaches, whether that be S&C coaches, sports-specific coaches, just really positive all the time, which was a little bit of a difference from England, because we can tend to be a little bit dry and sarcastic and not wanting to be overly positive all of the time. But it was a really interesting step to take into that sort of environment. But I really enjoyed it. The facility was just phenomenal. I mean, I think it's even changed since I've been there now. I mean, we had an incredible gym. I think they had 48 tennis courts, you know, NFL fields, football pitches. I mean, you name it, they had it. So, I mean, it was a fantastic facility to work at. And then you see the application of different athletes towards S&C and the importance it carries in the US. And so it was a big sort of eye-opener. I think they kind of called it Disneyland for S&C coaches, because it really was. I mean, you name a bit of equipment, they had it. They had space. They had everything going for them. So it was awesome.
I've never actually made it down there myself, but I've heard really great things about it, and everyone who has been extremely impressed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal facility. I mean, I believe Nick Bollettieri, who's the sort of guru of tennis coaching and has pretty much coached every tennis player that's ever been half decent, he started it way back when, and then IMG came in and just started expanding it, and the gym and the whole facility has just kind of gone through the roof over the past 15 years, really.
What athletes from what particular sports did you end up working with?
So, I mean, this was the great part about it was we got thrown right in at the deep end. We basically had, I think, about a week or two to watch and take notes, and then it was like, off you go. So we worked with American football, or as you guys would probably call it, football, so excuse me for that one, basketball, soccer, lacrosse, golf, and tennis. About seven different sports.
During your time there, what did you end up learning that was beneficial later on in your career?
I mean, it was fascinating. I mean, working with lots of different sports. So, I mean, obviously there's different exercises, different periodizations, different drills that people use for certain sports. So, for example, like the golfers, the tennis players, and the lacrosse players would do a lot for grip strength, because it was important for rotation and their sport, which was something I'd never come across. Is it something I'll probably use day in, day out? Maybe not. Is it something that probably over the course of my career I'll have to use maybe with a goalkeeper, or if I venture into a different sport? Probably. So it's always good to have that information and knowledge in the back of your head, and then you see how different sports use similar exercises but in slightly different ways. But I think the biggest interest to me was how you had to kind of adapt yourself depending on which sports you work with, whether it was the baseball, whether it was lacrosse, whether it was the football guys or the golf guys. You couldn't approach the golfers the same way you approach the lacrosse players, and you couldn't approach the tennis players the same way you approach the soccer players. So it's interesting to kind of see different personality dynamics within each sport.
Absolutely, and I've seen that also in college strength and conditioning. Obviously, you have different sports teams. Each one has a different culture around it, and you end up getting people with different personalities.
Of course, and I mean, I was kind of amazed. I'd always grown up working in football, and when you have a group of tennis players and you ask them to get in your twos and threes, they just kind of look at each other because they're so used to just being on their own. Whereas in football, you can shout twos and threes and people immediately get into it, you know, or if you raise your voice slightly with the golfers, they would kind of stop paying attention to you. Whereas if you were kind of quite mild and relaxed with the lacrosse players, they'd walk all over you and they wanted to be pumped up and they wanted high energy all the time. You know, so that was a really good learning curve. And that's interesting when you start to take that into a team environment, especially in the multicultural world of sort of football, particularly back home where, you know, I've worked with guys from Chile, from Korea, from Trinidad, from, you know, working class in England to middle class in England to Scotland, you know, all over the place. So you've got to appreciate all these different cultures and that sort of thing. So I think that's really helped me where I'm at now and kind of judging where people are at.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that just comes with the territory as you end up gaining experience. And this is why I'm always a big proponent of internships.
Oh, massively. I mean, the thing is nobody likes doing an internship. No one wants to do an internship. But I think sometimes it's a box you got to tick. And I felt really lucky that I got a fantastic opportunity to work in a fantastic facility where the coaches really did kind of push you to coach and learn it. You know, we did have to do menial tasks as well. So it's not saying that we didn't do that, but we were quite lucky in the amount of contact time we got with athletes in terms of actually coaching.
After IMG, you ended up returning back to England. Where did you transition to?
So it was a bit of a long process, really, in terms of coming back home, looking for work. I kind of found myself in a really tough position where it was overqualified for junior positions, but underexperienced for senior positions. So, I mean, we're probably talking maybe a year went by until the role at Cardiff came up, and I was lucky enough to start there. And we were in the Championship at the time, and there'd been a whole raft of changes with players, with staff, where Malky Mackay had come in and kind of wanted to revolutionize what was going on behind the scenes. So I kind of got a little bit lucky that there was a manager looking to do so many changes, and I was on board at that time.
What was your role at Cardiff?
So I was a head of strength conditioning. So we basically had one guy on the pitch. So head of fitness, he would do the warm-ups, the late stage return to play. And then I would do all the gym work. So that was sort of injury prevention work. That was strength work. That was working. I worked quite closely with a lot of rehab guys that were maybe having long-term injuries or even short-term injuries.
Just to get an understanding of how a championship club works. So you have your fitness manager, you have your head of strength conditioning. Did you also have sports scientists that were analyzing and collecting data?
Yeah, I mean, the Championship's a great league, and it literally depends on the support the department gets from the club. I mean, I know there's some departments that just run with one guy who's head of fitness, who does on pitch, who does the gym stuff, and he does all the analysis of data as well. But then I know Cardiff right now have a head of fitness, a strength conditioning guy, and a data analyst as well. So there's and that's probably not uncommon at that level. So, you know, anywhere between two and three guys would be fairly common at the Championship level.
How do departments work together? For example, you said that you would work with physiotherapists. How would you go about creating the program, the gym-based program for the players?
I mean, this is interesting. I mean, some departments you hear stories of that don't work together at all. I think I'd find that a very difficult situation to work in. I've been extremely lucky where I've worked with some incredible physios, some really proactive guys, some incredibly intelligent guys who were also keen on strength and conditioning. So every morning we would have a medical meeting where we go through the list of players. Okay, who's available, who's not available? This guy is in his rehab phase. Okay, today he needs some strength work. You know, so we'll maybe sit down at that point and go, okay, he's out for 4 weeks. What do we need to do in these 4 weeks in terms of on the pitch, in the gym, and with his bed-based treatment? So we try and tick every box. So then when that meeting comes up, it's like, hey, today, you know, he's got his strength circuit or, you know, his strength work to get done. And that's all built in towards the pattern of the week. So we know that we're not going to overload him one day and underload him another day. And it might be a case of where the physio goes, hey, you know, what exercise are you doing? Okay, we're going to do this, this, and this. Can you do something else instead of a Bulgarian, for example, because of I'm not keen on him doing this or this because of a particular reason? Okay, so then you have to work with them and adapt it. You know, there's no point just kind of going, well, you don't know what you're talking about. I do all the gym work and he's going to do the program I've written for him today. You know, so there's a little bit of give and take in that situation.
One of the big things in soccer, football, depending what country you are, I'm sure everybody out there who's listening to this podcast know what we're talking about, but there's this idea of whether or not periodization actually works. And some people say that it's antiquated, it doesn't work in soccer because of how dynamic it is. What are your ideas about it?
In terms of strength work or on the pitch
work? In terms of strength work.
I mean, in terms of strength work, it's really difficult. I mean, I went in at Shrewsbury and I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to do this periodization for this amount of time, and this is going to be his loaded weeks, and this is going to be his unloaded weeks. And then a cup game happens or a reserve team game happens. And, you know, all of a sudden you might have no cup game, but then seven of the players that didn't play for the first team are now playing for the reserve team on Monday instead. So they had a strength session on that month. So it gets very complicated. I think the point we miss is, realistically, how many football players are at a true level of strength where it would be in, say, a rugby league environment, a rugby union environment, maybe an Aussie rules environment where, hey, we need to get these guys peaked. We need to get everything completely bang on. I don't think many footballers, particularly that I've come across, I mean, some people might have come across others, but have got a great training age where we have to stick to certain loads on certain weeks. I think a lot of footballers have movement deficiencies. So I think we should maybe focus on getting them moving correctly before we really start loading them correctly. You know, and that's not saying not to load them. That's just saying, hey, make sure they can hip hinge, make sure, you know, we've got full range in a squat pattern and single leg patterns. And without that, you know, how far along the line is making sure that we work to a certain percentage each week when the guy can't stand on one leg, when the guy hasn't got full range in his squat, when the guy can't sit back through his hips. So I think, honestly, I'm not sure there's a full need for it. I think as long as we get them moving better and we load them when we can. I mean, like you say, depending on the fixture list, I mean, the championship can be crazy. Sometimes you go 5-6 weeks, 2 games a week. So listen, you might not be able to do much, but then there's other periods that you might have 5-6 weeks where you have 1 game a week. So you might be able to do a little bit there. So I think you've just got to respect the game in terms of the fixtures and not be too stuck in your ways and go, no, well, today they were supposed to lift that X amount of percent and that's the only way. Well, hey, you know, the guy's got to play a reserve team game because he hasn't played a game in 3 weeks and he needs the fitness.
Yeah, and I think that's something that definitely gets overlooked, especially by strength and conditioning people in the United States that haven't worked in a soccer environment. They see soccer players as being weak or not wanting to do strength work. And while, yeah, that might be the case with people coming from certain backgrounds and cultures, they also have to understand that many times, especially even in the college environment, we're playing 2 games each weekend. We're playing on a Friday and Sunday. You have to become adaptable.
And that's a big thing, you know. Is there times that I would love to do more strength work with squads? Absolutely. But at the same time, you know, for me to get a session in when it's Saturday, Tuesday, yes, some of the boys might be able to get a lift in, but if you're a starting 11 player and you're nailed on to start week in, week out, you know, I'm going to have to bite the bullet here. Listen, S&C I think is extremely important, but it's not more important than them playing. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, you've got to respect the fixture list and, you know, where some sports like rugby tend to only have 1 game a week, like the NFL, you know, these sports lend themselves more to being able to do that. Whereas football, like I say, you've got to be a little bit more cautious and just respect it, because at the end of the day, if you start to get pushy with the players and they get a little bit sore, you'll be the first one that gets a finger pointed at them, you know. So sometimes you got to go slowly. It's not enjoyable, but sometimes it takes 12 weeks to achieve what you really want to achieve in maybe 5 or 6.
You're talking that many footballers have movement deficiencies, and something that you've prided yourself throughout your career is decreasing injury rates and enhancing player availability for matches. I believe you mentioned that in 2013, 2014, during the time of Malcolm McKay, When you're at Cardiff City, that the club actually had the highest player availability in the EPL or English Premiership. How was this accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, I think the major component to that was we had a whole team that was working together for it. So it came right down from the manager through the assistant manager to the head of performance, to the physios, to the fitness coaches. So we were all on the same page of what we wanted to achieve. The manager was all for everything we did. So he supported us. So if we said, right, these players have to do this today and they'll be out on the pitch 15 minutes later or a half hour later, no problem. The players have to recover today. They can't go on the pitch. No problem. So that was really big. And it took a little bit of time in terms of educating players, but I think there was a real common sense approach taken to it. Obviously, we movement screened the guys, we did strength work, we did injury prevention work. That injury prevention work was based off screening that we did throughout the year with them in terms of movement screening or physio-based screening that we did with them. So we didn't just collect data on them, we tried to hopefully correct them a little bit. But it was also very lucky that we took a common sense approach of, hey, you know, this guy's played 8 games in maybe 5 weeks. You know, he's had a long injury history. You know, do we necessarily need to throw him back out there today? Or would he be better just doing a bit of getting his rub down from the masseuse, doing his injury prevention work, and then going home? You know, so sometimes we try to work on the basis that every player did what we called like a hit, you know, like a fitness session, obviously with the ball, like a conditioning session, but small sided games and that sort of stuff twice a week. So obviously if they were playing Saturday, Tuesday, this was a kind of 2 hits a week. So we kind of just took a common sense approach of, hey, who's got what problems? We need to be wary of certain players at certain times of the year. For example, this player's just had a baby 2 nights ago. He's not sleeping. So he might need to be a little bit careful with him of what he does for the next couple of days, because he's probably not slept right. So his pattern's all over the place. He's probably going to be a little bit fatigued, maybe a little bit increased risk of his injury. You know, that might be once again different from a player that's never had a soft tissue injury that might be 23 to a 32-year-old player that's had a history of calf strains or rec fems or hamstrings. So it's just taking a common sense approach where we'd sit and discuss it through our medical meetings, really.
Absolutely. What movement assessment did you use at Cardiff?
So over the time, we kind of used a couple different ones. So we kind of mixed in a GEMS one, which was a Joanna Elfenstein one, with some FMS movements as well, just because the physio wanted some movement tests and I kind of wanted some other tests. So we kind of came to a conclusion that we could try and do a mixture of both. It wasn't necessarily perfect, but with bed-based testing and dynamometry testing, you know, it worked out fairly well, and we kind of got to areas that we wanted to, and we worked together to make sure, okay, a test that I want to do and you want to do a different test, do we need to do both tests, or will they kind of overlap in what they're looking to tell us?
Based on the testing that you did, were there any common movement dysfunctions overall that you saw from footballers?
They generally all spend a lot of their day doing exactly the same thing. So nuances between every single one of them, but generally they'll have poor hamstring flexibility. They'll be really tight through the hip flexors. They won't be able to fire their glutes, you know, and that will be the general pattern of it. You know, most of them will not necessarily have brilliant posture either, which won't help. So those are generally the key areas that I would say. And maybe some would lack a lot of ankle mobility.
I mean, the reason that I asked that question is, I know it's tough to generalize and everybody is unique, but I've also seen commonalities among players that play a sport simply because of the loading patterns that they have day in and day out.
Of course. I mean, it's like anything. If you're going to spend all day sat on a bike, you're going to have certain, you know, impingements and certain muscle groups that get shorter and others get longer. You know, if you spend all day hitting a tennis ball, yeah, you might hit it slightly differently, but the chances are generally you might be tight in similar areas to other tennis players. If you're a runner, if you play baseball, and if you play football, you know, generally the players will probably be really poor around the hip region, you know, tight in the front, not being able to fire in the back, just because they spent all day just shortening hip flexors, yep. You know?
What happened after Cardiff? What?
So I had a medical. We had a change of manager at Cardiff, and I had a medical the following season, went to Wigan Athletic and asked me to go and work with him. And if anyone gets a chance to meet a guy called Richard Collins, take the opportunity because he's an unbelievable physio. So to get the chance to work with him again was something that I was really, really keen on doing. So it was a new challenge as well, going into a club. So I jumped at the chance and moved up to Wigan.
Did you have the same role at Wigan that you did at Cardiff?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it was termed slightly differently. I mean, it was known as head of athletic development, but I think that was more of a, I mean, I'm not too sure why. I mean, football has its strange reasons for changing certain titles and whatnot. So, but I mean, it was pretty much overall the same role.
At Wigan, you instituted a four-stage screening system to screen players that were high risk for injury. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, to be fair, most of our players went through the similar preseason testing. So what that would do would then highlight the high risk players from that. So the four-stage screen test was obviously bed-based with the physios. Then they do some muscle dynamometry, so looking at ratios of certain muscle groups. Then we go into a FMS test, and then they did on-pitch testing. So it was the sort of yo-yo testing, the sprint testing, and going from there.
What exactly were you looking for? How would you characterize a person being high risk versus a person being low risk?
I mean, for me personally, I mean, I was looking after the FMS. So when you start looking at the research, it's kind of 14 and below, asymmetries, and that sort of thing. So what we were able to do was link in some of the FMS testing with some of the bed-based testing. So we could go, okay, well, in this particular FMS test, say, okay, in the hurdle step, he had this issue. And the physio would be like, hey, well, actually, when I was on the bed with him, he had the same issue. So we were able to kind of align some of those results. Okay, these are some of the problems he had. Okay, this is his left hip really seems to be the problem. Okay, it's his right ankle seems to be really causing him issues at the minute. So we were kind of overlapped. So we had a meeting and we went through every player, and every person had their own input, whether it be the physio from the bed-based treatment, the dynamometry, the fitness guys on the pitch, and then myself who do the movement stuff in the gym. And we kind of go, okay, these are our findings, and we collate that together to kind of bring in, okay, what is this guy's high priorities? What's his history of injuries? What's maybe caused those injuries? And then how do we actually go about making sure he doesn't get those injuries again, or at least try and maximize his availability to the team?
Yeah, and this is where it's really important. Something that we were discussing before is to be able to work together the different departments. Because if you're just kind of doing it on your own, you're not going to be able to get the expertise from the physiotherapist, from the fitness person on the pitch, to be able to create and collaborate and give the best possible outcome to the player.
No, I mean, of course not. I mean, I think we will go into the industry with probably a certain little bit of arrogance of, you know, we can change the world, and I can tell you everything you need to know. And then when you start to get to a point of, oh, actually, he'd maybe slightly better than me at that particular thing. And that's not being disrespectful to each individual. You know, for example, could I write a nutrition program for someone? Yeah. Would it be as good as a nutritionist? Absolutely not. So if I then say that the nutritionist can't work with the player because I'm going to do it, the player's getting a worse service. So I'm not doing justice to that player. So yeah, I might think I know everything about the player's movement and I can prescribe everything for him. But physios have when they actually get their hands on players, can see something completely differently. So, you know, who am I to kind of suggest that their information that they're bringing to the table is wrong or useless? You know, that's, I think, quite an arrogant point of view. And I think if we go into it as a team and, hey, if we keep these players on the pitch, it's thanks to all of us. It's not thanks to one of us. You know, and vice versa. You know, if we have a recurrent injury, you know, it's not just one of us. It's all of us. And we need to look at what we're doing.
Exactly. And I think that's something that's definitely missed, especially from I see this a lot from younger strength and conditioning coaches that don't have a lot of experience. They may get their FMS and all of a sudden they think, oh, this physiotherapist doesn't know what they're talking about because they're using some antiquated system or they're not up to date. And you have to respect the fact that they did a lot of schooling and they come from a different background and they also have a lot of knowledge.
Of course you do. And I think it gets to a point where I think we've kind of forgotten about the term experience. And we put too much on research and reading and the latest journals coming out. And we forget to go, hey, this guy's been a top physio for 15 years. He's working day in, day out. Okay, what do you think the problem here might be? Okay, what did you find there? I found this. Okay, well, if you found, yeah, well, last time I found it, it might be this problem. You know, and I think we kind of completely overlook experience. And I think that's such a key thing to progressing our environment that we don't just take on research. Of course, research is important, but we need to speak to people. Okay, this guy's been in the game 20 years. I'm having a problem with this player. Well, I've only ever had that once before, but when we had that, it might have been this. You know, and I might have been stumped on it. So, because I might not have the experience he's had, and hopefully that maybe one day in 10, 15 years' time, that I can say to a younger fitness coach, hey, have you maybe thought about this? Because back in 2015, I had a player and this was his problem and I did this and it helped him. Okay, we'll give it a go.
Yeah, and like you said, I think experience and in the trench work sometimes gets put aside for someone who may have a PhD and has done a ton of research, but has that person, while they have done all this research in academia, has that person actually been in the environment for 10 to 15 years, working with players day in and day out?
Of course. I mean, I heard an expression once, you know, have you got 10 years experience or have you got 1 year's experience 10 times? You know, are you doing the same things that you're doing now that you were 10 years ago, having not progressed, or every day have you progressed? And I think if you're progressing every day, you can speak to other people that are progressing every day and hopefully come to some answers where you might be stuck and kind of take the arrogance out of it and go, hey, I need a little bit of help here. Can you help me out?
Absolutely. Moving on, outside of just purely injury prevention at Wigan, you also were using mini screens post-match to assess players.
Yeah. So what we do is we would have a couple, what we call like return to training tests. So it was knee to wall, bent knee fallout, and then the sit and reach test. This was something that was mainly one of the physio's ideas. So we kind of came to the conclusion of, hey, it might be worthwhile doing this. And we can see where our players are when they first come back, because some players finish Saturday and we'll sit on the couch all day Sunday, come in Monday, and yeah, their ankle might have seized up, you know, they might be tight in one of the groins, whatever, you know. So we kind of just really trialed it. So we started looking at, okay, what's their average score when they come in, you know, what they usually get on their knee to wall, what they usually get on their bent knee fallout. Okay, well, it might be their right side's down. Okay, well, before you step out on that pitch, you need to, you know, trigger point this area, you need to foam roll this area, maybe the physio needs to get hands on and mob a certain joint for you. So we weren't kind of sending the guys out onto the pitch when they were jacked up, really. That was the main thought process behind it. And to be honest, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was excellent.
Since Wigan, you mentioned that you're now with Exos. How did that come about?
So I did a mentorship. I can't even remember what the year was now, about maybe 3-4 years ago. I'd obviously heard a lot about Exos. I contacted some of the coaches, one guy in particular, a guy called Darcy Norman, who I'm sure you've heard about, just a phenomenal practitioner and a phenomenal guy to boot alongside that. And I started researching more into it and wanting to know more about it. So I went on to the mentorship, loved every minute of it, liked the philosophy, liked the methodology. It was something that really kind of struck a chord with me, something that I kind of really felt that aligned with my thought process behind it. That's not to say that I had the exact same methodology as Exos, but the principles behind it, should I say. And from that point, I got recommended. And over the course of a couple of years, there'd been a few things that had kind of come up. And this was the one that I kind of decided to plump for. You know, it was a football job in Brazil, so I couldn't really turn it down.
How does Exos work in terms of getting a position at a specific club?
I think it varies, really. I mean, from certain players recommending them to clubs hearing of their work and going and speaking to them. You know, I believe it, obviously, post-World Cup, where you had the German national team who blew the tournament away, obviously people start to go, hey, well, what were they doing? It starts to just become popular within certain genres. So whether it's football or whether it might be tennis or baseball, I mean, for a long period of time, they've been hugely successful with the NFL combine athletes. So it's one of those things that they just start to build their reputation and then the results kind of speak for themselves. And then because the results seemingly are always so good, people want to be part of that. So whether that be a club or whether that be an NFL combine athlete or whether that's an NFL vet or an NBA guy that wants to get in shape before the season.
You mentioned that you looked at a variety of positions and you really liked this one in Brazil. What in particular drew you towards it?
I think there's a couple different things, really. I think firstly, football in Brazil kind of has a bit of a ring to it. I think probably the only other place it could maybe call itself home of football, apart from England, would be Brazil. I thought it'd be fascinating to see how a different culture did it, how they went about it, why do they produce so many players, what's the structure like. And I also thought the other part of it was a personal development part to go to a different country, try and learn language, which is incredibly difficult, by the way, and almost appreciate what some of the foreign players go through when they actually join a club in England. You know, so we kind of often spend a lot of money on players from Europe or South America or, you know, all over the world, and it's like, hey, here's your apartment and come into training and that's you sorted. So to hopefully give me a kind of eye-opener of what these guys go through in the future, you know, how can I help them settle in? What can I do with a certain club that can help them settle in? And that sort of thing.
What has your experience been so far in Brazil?
Thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been very different, but good. You know, I've been surprised at a lot of stuff. I mean, sometimes your first thought, I think in England we sometimes have an arrogance that, oh, you know, we're the best in the world. In terms of the club setups, you know, we're the best in the world. No one else would be doing it as good as us. And then it's not until you maybe step outside of that bubble that you kind of say, hey, you know, other people do a great job. You know, and Atletico Paranaense have a real great reputation for heavily investing off the pitch in terms of, hey, analysis, every player has an iPad. Okay, we'll get the Exos guys in and we can make sure that we improve their strength, their movement, everything to go alongside the performance. They've got a nutritionist that comes in from Exos to work with that. I think they were the first club in the whole of Brazil to have GPS. You know, so they've really invested heavily off the pitch. So that was a real pleasant surprise that it was kind of like kind of coming to a European club almost.
Was there any difference culturally in terms of buy-in towards strength and conditioning or sports science?
Sports science wise, no, because they had always kind of worn GPS units since they got them. They'd had CK markers taken after every game, had always done an HRV test, so the buy-in was always good for that. The slight difference in terms of strength conditioning is, surprisingly, we always kind of have a thought process back home that Brazilians just want to play football. They never want to do any gym work and they just want to play more football. I actually found quite the opposite. They really enjoy their gym work. The only slight difference is they enjoy doing machines, you know, leg extension, leg press, calf extension, those sorts of things. So that's been the education. I mean, we it's not uncommon to see players literally, it might be a game that kicks off at 10 o'clock the night before and they're in first thing the next morning and they're trying to do strength work on their legs. Or it might be the morning of a game and they're trying to do strength work on their legs. It's slightly different. They're all for it, but it's just educating them, okay, when to do it, how to do it, and why you're doing what you're doing.
I'm actually quite surprised because I was in that boat where I thought that many Brazilians, especially the Brazilian clubs, the players really enjoyed playing but didn't enjoy the strength conditioning work. So this is actually pretty eye-opening for me.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I can only judge from one club, so other clubs may be completely different. But I mean, I think we had about an 8-week period where we had Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday, Wednesday, and a few of the players were frustrated because it was like a Thursday game and a Saturday game and we weren't doing strength on the Friday.
Have you tried to introduce any of the ideas or concepts that you use in England into this new club in terms of strength and conditioning? You mentioned that they love to do a lot of machine work, but have you tried to institute anything else beyond that?
What we did is we were quite lucky is we kind of got rid of all the machines, basically. So we emptied the gym. So we've gone down the sort of Exos methodology of focusing on movement, making sure that guys can have full range, make sure they're working through the correct patterns, make sure they can do basic movements, working through mobility, stability, and going from there, really. So we just really implemented the Exos methodology, but in Brazil.
And the players were fine with this, or was there any hesitancy?
I think a few of the players still kind of, I mean, the machines, although we've got them out at the gym, are still at the facility, and I think it's not uncommon to see players sneaking off and doing some of the machines. but that's somewhat of a long process. You know, we've been here 5 months, so the changes they've made already have been phenomenal. So it does maybe take them a little bit of time to wean off their old habits. And it's also better that they're kind of trying to do good stuff as opposed to us weaning them off bad habits, you know, like not doing any strength training.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously easier to make that transition when you have players that are already invested in strength and conditioning rather than players who have never done it at all.
Exactly, exactly.
So part of Historic Performance, the reason that I created this, beyond creating conversation here in the United States between strength and conditioning coaches, sports scientists, and technical coaches, is to give advice to young coaches that are interested in soccer strength and conditioning. What would be some advice that you would have for someone that is just coming out of university?
Okay. Probably go down a few different routes with this one. Firstly, get your education, and that's not just university wise, that's in the field as well. So you have to volunteer for stuff. You know, there's a lot of cold, wet, windy nights that I've done stuff that I didn't want to do, but it's beneficial in long term. That it's really important for you to complete. You know, it's important for you to learn off other professionals, more experienced professionals, and you start to see, okay, well, this is what the book tells me, but hey, when you get into the actual environment, it's almost impossible to do. So people do it this way as opposed to that way. So that's the main one that I'd say to start with is get educated and get your experience. The other one I'd say is don't give away your experience for free too much. So it gets to a point that, yes, you need to do internships, but if you're doing an internship for a third or fourth year, you know, you need to say no at a certain point because you've got a certain value. I think the last two that I would say is get your CV and cover letter, or sorry, your resume and your cover letter right, because it's something that I was never actually taught how to do in university. And I happened to fall on some guy who was a CV expert and tore my CV limb from limb. And I couldn't believe I'd been sending it off to apply to jobs after the things he told me and the way I should write it and how best to put myself across. And the difference between before and after in getting interviews was night and day. Before, I could hardly get an interview. And then as soon as he changed it, I was getting maybe 50% rate of interviews. So that's how important it is. And lastly, knock on every door possible, whether it be other strength coaches, whether it's you find email addresses from them, whether it's you get hold of them on Twitter, you know, LinkedIn, you know, lots of different ways nowadays to be really proactive and chase people down. And listen, maybe quite a lot won't reply to you, but the ones that do, you'll really learn stuff from. And I was really lucky that I managed to kind of fall on top of a couple people's email addresses that I emailed, and they were phenomenal in getting back to me, far more experienced coaches than I were, and helped me. And still to this day, I email them for advice, you know. So that's probably the last one, you know, don't give up and knock on all the doors possible.
That is something that I hear from almost every strength coach that I've interviewed on this podcast, is each single one of them has had one mentor or multiple mentors throughout their career that they're really grateful for.
Oh, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I mean, I emailed someone who had, I mean, I'd emailed quite a lot of people, and it was the highest rated person that didn't know me from Adam. I wrote down maybe 7 or 8 questions, and I've still got the email to this day, because it was probably about a 4-page reply he wrote to me. So he'd gone out of his way to help me out, and, you know, I'll forever kind of owe him for that. And that's why these days, if anyone kind of asks me for advice, I try as best as I can to respond to, whether it be emails or LinkedIn messages, to kind of help people out, because I know it can be a really frustrating period. I mean, I think I went over maybe 100, 150 applications or emails to try and get stuff with no luck. So sometimes you kind of need a little bit of luck, or you need a little bit of advice at the right time. So I was lucky that I had that. So hopefully if I can pass that on at any point, you know, I think karma and whatnot is good for it. But I also think it's good for the industry and good to develop relationships with amongst our union, almost, of other fitness coaches.
Caleb, if anyone has any questions for you or any comments, what's the best way that they can contact you?
Probably if they get me on Twitter, it is at Walshy2123. So that's Walshy2123. And if they want to message me on there or tweet me on there, and then if we want to go further and they want to drop me an email, that won't be a problem at all.
Perfect. And I'm going to link that when I publish the podcast. That way it will be there and they don't need to be frantically trying to write it down.
Awesome.
Caleb, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you have any questions or comments for Callum Walsh, please feel free to reach out to him. He'll be more than willing, as he mentioned in the podcast, to write back to your email. He's deeply indebted to a lot of people who mentored him throughout the way, and he's really a great guy and a great resource. If you've been enjoying the podcast episodes, please make sure to follow me on Twitter at Historic Perform. And you can view all previous episodes at my website, www.historicperformance.net. See you next time.